moving data to space, and rescuing a falling spacecraft. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. Data, it runs the world. But what happens if data is erased or lost altogether after a natural disaster here on Earth? One option, send it to space before that can happen. We'll speak with Chris Dott with Lone Star Data Holdings about the plan to store data off our planet. Then a telescope in space is falling, and this month NASA and its partners are launching a mission to save it. The company Catalyst Space will send a robotic spacecraft to boost NASA's Swift Observatory higher into orbit, about 370 miles above Earth. We'll revisit a conversation with Catalyst Space Gani Lee about that rescue mission. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? How do we store and protect data? One way is to send it into space for safekeeping. Companies like Lone Star Data Holdings are doing just that. The company has launched four missions, two to the International Space Station and two to the Moon, testing their data centers and technology to transfer data back and forth. And soon, an episode of this show will head into orbit. Here to talk more about all of this is Lone Star Data Holdings, Chris Dott. Chris, welcome to Are We There Yet?
Well, thank you for having me, Brendan. I've really been looking forward to this. Great fan.
Yeah, excellent. Well, thank you, Chris. I'm looking forward to chat with you. We're going to talk about data in space, but before we do that, I've got a simple question that probably has a very complex answer. Why is it important that we send our data off this planet?
Because it is so valuable. We can't leave it down here where it's at such risk. You know, the most valuable commodity in the world today is data. It runs our lives, our economies, our companies, our governments. Even right now, we're creating data by talking through the computers like this. It is the very wellspring of everything that we do as a species. And the thing is, where it has the most value down here on Earth is also where it's at the most risk. Everything from natural disasters to wars, as we're now seeing, where data is directly targeted, from data centers to cable fibers to all the infrastructure that we have. And the way I always think about this is the Library of Alexandria, a data loss so bad that we still talk about it 2,000 years later. And I don't know about you, but sometimes I wake up and I go, oh my gosh, what books were lost? So imagine if that happened today.
I think what's difficult is thinking about data in the sense of the Library of Alexandria, right? Data is something that now is so digital, it's kind of everywhere, but we really don't know that. There is a physical piece of data for every digital piece, right? It has to exist somewhere, right?
Exactly. And where is that? I mean, the cloud, sadly, is not a cloud. It's these very large buildings called data centers, and we're building more of them all the time. And they're very similar to satellites, by the way. You know, one just happens to be on the ground and one in space. They form similar functions. But when you move this up into space, you're away from all the terrestrial problems. You're away from all the human error, the accidents. You're away from a lot of the hacking that goes on, if not all of it. And you're in a place where you've got unlimited access to solar energy, technically fusion powered, I guess if you want to push it for the audience, and natural cooling. I mean, we've been doing satellites in space for 69 years now. This October, 1957, for Sputnik. Next year, right, the 70th anniversary. So this is a technology that's been around for a while, but now we're just putting it to a different use, an incredible use that benefits all of us by taking that most valuable thing and putting it somewhere really safe.
Chris, tell me about some of the work that Lone Star Data Holdings has done so far to kind of prove this concept of storing data off this planet. What have you done and what have you sent?
No, thank you. Yeah, we've done four missions to date and we're getting ready for our fifth. Four test flights. Two up to the International Space Station. That was in 2021 and 2022, where we actually put software-defined data centers up on the space station. We checked everything from blockchain to disaster recovery. We ran an LLM, an early adversarial art network, and we even made cryptocurrencies up there. Non-pennyware again, it was just testing out the software. But it worked really well. Did that twice. And then we did the same thing up to the moon twice. We did it in 2024, a software-defined data center. We flew that with Intuitive Machines. We were transmitting documents on the way to the moon, backwards and forwards, checksum, refresh and restore, like a digital hard drive, all the way from the surface of the moon itself. Our tests worked. It was wonderful. And then last year, we did it again to the moon, this time with hardware. SSDs, solid-state devices, about 8 terabytes worth of field programmable Gatorade chip, a polarifier, delay-tolerant networks for Vint Cerf and his team, all the way through to Knowledge Graphs for Valkyrie Intelligence, an AI company, to data for disaster recovery for 8 governments around the world. And then this October, our first fully commercial mission, launching out of Vandenberg Space Force Base with 488 terabytes on board. And our customers to date are governments, social media networks. These are corporates, NGOs, people who have regulated data that needs to be kept in the right data sovereignty bucket. Oh gosh, I can talk for hours on that. Don't worry, I won't. But isn't that a cool thing? It's just the idea that, you know, just when we need this technology the most, it's there. And we've proven it out. And now we're going fully commercial. Different kind of data center in space than some of the others.
Chris, that mission that's launching later this year that's going to polar orbit, you mentioned that you're starting to go from software to hardware. Tell me a bit about what you are sending up into space, because I've got, you know, a solid state hard drive right here on my computer. Are you just taking one of those and launching it off the planet? Or you know what, is there specialized hardware that you need to use? Tell me about it.
I wish it was that easy, Brendan.
Okay.
Yeah, no, we're taking specialized hardware. We work with our provider, Phison, to actually take specific space qualified solid state devices, SSDs. And so this is that 488 terabytes are going up in our first star vault up into polar orbit. You'll be able to see it pass overhead almost, you know, a couple of times a day. And it'll be up there for 5 years. It's about 6.5 kilograms of mass. And we're building two of these, and another one goes up next year, and on and on and on.
Chris, it's also important to recover data, right? You're using this to protect data off this planet. You mentioned earlier how you were transmitting data to and from the moon. How does this kind of technology work in retrieving data? Will we be able to listen to this podcast episode while it's in space?
Actually, yes, what we do is we bring it back down for you. So we use radio spectrum, RF, radio frequency, just like Starlink, but for disasters, for us, for data. The idea, just like satellite TV, same kind of radio waves, same kind of spectrum frequency of those dishes in the garden. And we actually send the data up to the device, like an external hard drive. So I think Time Machine, if you have a Mac. And then same thing, you would come to us and say, Chris, are we there yet? And I say, almost. And they go, okay. And they say, okay, well, let's bring it back down. And so we would actually have it. It would actually be sent via the satellite as it passes over Florida. And it would come down to a landing station at a big antenna farm here. And then it just pop right into your email, like Dropbox in space. It would come right back to you.
That is fascinating. What are some of the challenges that you still need to overcome with this? It sounds like you've had some very successful test missions, both on the software and the hardware side. But what do you still need to learn to make this effective?
This is this moment of scale for us, where we start really pushing out with the customer base that we have. Customers for us are the most important thing in the world, because they have a need for this, and we have to fix that need and do it quickly. And so that's the big one for us. The world is becoming a lot more volatile. I think, as we've just seen, for the listeners, you know, we're about 63 days from the beginning of the Iran war. On March 2nd and March the 1st, the two big data centers for AWS were targeted with drones in the United Arab Emirates, and they're still down. And so what's been happening is we were going up against protecting against natural disaster, human error, people having accidents, hacking. And then all of a sudden, data has become a literal target during warfare. And we're seeing that in Europe and Ukraine and other places. So the biggest trouble for us is to get as much up as we can and get those people protected.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Chris Stott of Lone Star Data Holdings about moving our data off of this planet for safekeeping in space and on the moon. Is there a limit to how much you can get into space? I mean, I've got to imagine space is called space for that reason. There's a lot of it. I mean, is there kind of an upper limit as to how much data you can get off this planet?
You know, that's a great question. No one's ever asked us that question before, Brendan. That's a really good question. You know, I mean, we are capacity constrained. I mean, the idea that, you know, we can, our goal though, is to get back up and to have 100 petabytes, which is 100,000 terabytes, which is, my math gets really bad, which is gigabytes and megabytes. But then also, when we're ready, because we've already been to the moon once, we want to go back to the moon, lunar orbit and then down into the lava tubes. And then we want to get up to the exabyte and then yottabyte level facilities for storage.
I have never heard of a yottabyte.
Is it
like a yacht-sized amount of storage?
Yes, it's a huge amount of storage. Well, I mean, and the other one I had to look up was quintillion. So like every day, the human race creates, at the moment, 660 quintillion bytes of new data, more than yesterday. That's 660 exabytes, that is 660,000 petabytes. I mean, it is a staggering what's going on. And it's growing exponentially with all the AI that we're doing. And every time we open a new app, every time we do something new in life, I mean, babies today are born with their own personal data cloud. From the moment they emerge into this world, they have a whole little file opened up. And that's the, you know, that's their medical data, this data, that data, where they are on the GPS, and they're moving around in the hospital, what kind of medications. And it goes with you for the rest of your life, your music cloud, your school records, your personal financial records, what you do at work. I mean, it's amazing. It's all about data.
Chris, we're sending this episode to space. That's kind of cool. That's not kind of cool. That's awesome and really cool. Can you talk to us about some of the practical uses that you've seen interest in with what is the draw to this, other than the novelty of us sending this podcast into space, which we appreciate.
Other than the fact that it's incredibly cool, right? I know we love it. I mean, that's a great thing about space. Well, for a lot of the governments that we work with and the corporations, it is about resiliency. This is continuity of operations, command and control. This is going up against your worst day scenario. And so it's the idea of having that Library of Alexandria type backup for civilization. But for the governments, it's okay. I need a backup for this because my data is intentionally targeted. I need for corporations. I have regulated data. I am legally required to keep a backup. For example, the European Union, GDPR, General Data Protection Regulations. There's now something called DORA, like Dora the Explorer. Really cool. But it means that every single financial institution in the European Union, from bank to pension fund to stockbroker, by law, must have a digital disaster recovery plan in place. It's become that important. And so those are the customers that come to us. They say, look, I can't live without this data. And I'm also, from a regulatory point of view, I am required to do this. And the option that you're giving us of putting it in space where it's immutable, where the hackers can't get to it, where I can use that as a reference body. When we started doing this, everyone thought we were completely mad. No one will put data centers in space. Well, there's many different types, but now you've got everyone from SpaceX to Amazon to Blue Origin to a whole host of others doing it. Well, you're mad became common sense. And what we do is store the data that is created. We're the ultimate bank vault for data.
I'm wondering, what kind of security are you thinking about for the data that you send up there? Is the fact that it is in space secure enough from there? Or do you have to think about space piracy?
No, we do. We actually think about all of that. We have help from the government, several governments actually, in working what we call anti-tamper. And then for us, the customer encrypts. It goes into their encrypted S3 bucket data vault under their data sovereignty. We then encrypt the modulation scheme backwards and forwards. It is a place where people can't come touch it, move it, change it. And even getting into the system to try and do that, the way we've set it up so far, we hope, is incredibly difficult to do. High latency equals high security because you're not using TCP/IP. It's timing out. No brute force attacks. It's just that subtle difference. It doesn't seem that much. A second here and a second there. To you and I, it's nothing. But to a machine, it's everything.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for joining us.
Brendan, thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure. And I actually do really listen. So thank you.
I appreciate that, Chris. And I'm looking forward to sending the show up into space. So thanks for taking us on the ride in October. We appreciate
it. Absolutely.
That.
Thank you.
That was Chris Stott with Lone Star Data Holdings. Still to come, saving a falling spacecraft.
We're going to grapple with it using robotic arms onto structural members that weren't designed as grapple interfaces. And we'll have three of these robotic arms that grab onto it. And once we're docked, we'll boost with our robotic spacecraft thrusters to raise its orbit from around 350 kilometers up to around 600 kilometers so that it can continue its mission.
How NASA and partners plan to save the Swift Observatory. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. Humans just returned to the moon for the first time in decades, and NASA has a plan to land humans on the surface as soon as 2028. These moon missions are inspiring other missions to Mars. We'll talk about the future of missions to the Red Planet on a future episode of Are We There Yet? But for now, we're talking about a plan to save a falling spacecraft. The Swift Observatory launched from Cape Canaveral back in 2004. It was supposed to last into the 2030s, but the atmosphere is dragging it down from its orbit. The satellite studies gamma ray bursts, or giant explosions caused by things like stars dying. Well, later this month, commercial company Catalyst Space will launch its Link robotic spacecraft to attempt to rescue it. It will attach to the telescope and boost it into its original orbit in space, some 370 miles above Earth. We spoke with Gani Lee, CEO of Catalyst Space, back in December about the mission and the company's plan to save SWIFT. Here's that conversation now. Gani, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks so much, Brendan. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great to have you. You are working on something super cool and super fascinating. Can you just briefly tell me a bit about what the SWIFT Observatory is and why it needs your help?
The SWIFT Observatory is a NASA space telescope that is conducting planetary science and studying the universe. It's actually one of the most bang for your buck science instruments when it comes to cost per unit science. It's been in operation continuously for about the last 20 years, and it's in low Earth orbit. Over the next few months, the plan right now is that SWIFT might deorbit because it's hitting the atmosphere. And the unique part of what our mission is as Catalyst is we're building a robotic servicing spacecraft that's going to launch into space, grab onto the telescope, and reboost it higher into orbit so we can continue its science mission.
Let's talk a little bit about the need for that. Satellites go up there. There's nothing really to help them out if they run into any issues. Your company, Catalyst Space Technologies, is almost like a tech supporter or an ambulance service for these things, right? What is the need for these kind of in-orbit servicing for satellites?
That's exactly right. The future of space operations is very dynamic. In the past, we would have these static systems where you would launch a satellite on top of a big rocket and it would blast off into space and that'd be the last time you would ever touch it and you would just hope for the best. And that worked pretty well through the 20th century and early 21st century. But now maneuvers are more prevalent, right? You want to be able to move your satellites around as conditions change, right? You might actually have anomalies on orbit where you need to repair things. And all of these capabilities are what our robotic satellites are designed to do.
Tell me a bit about this particular mission to save SWIFT. How are you going to do it, Gani?
This is a really radical departure from traditional space operations. We've partnered with NASA. They've been really forward-leaning. You know, every few years, they take a look and inventory of all of their major space assets and say, hey, what is our plan for the next few years? And they looked at this, and about a year ago, I was looking like they might have to retire the SWIFT Observatory. But this is where they got really innovative. The team at NASA has been great. They said, hey, what if instead of retiring the asset, we could use a robotic servicing mission to reboost it? Because the instruments are still good. It's still producing active science. Right. And so they reached out to a bunch of different industry providers of these types of services. They asked us to put together a proposal of what it would look like. How fast could you move? How much would it cost? Right. And it was kind of a really crazy mission. Like you said, it was like, are we really going to use a space robot to go grab onto a telescope that was never designed to be serviced? Right. Like that sounds like out of a movie, but that's really what was asked of us. Right. And so NASA ended up making the decision to award this contract and move forward in September of 2025 with a planned launch date of June 2026, right? That is less than a year. That is so out of normal when it comes to space operations. Typical space missions are planned 3 to 5 years in advance. And in this case, because we have the tight deadline, we just had to move much faster. So we're building a dedicated robotic spacecraft that will launch into low Earth orbit. We're going to grapple with it using robotic arms onto structural members that weren't designed as grapple interfaces. And we'll have three of these robotic arms that grab onto it. And once we're docked, we'll boost with our robotic spacecraft thrusters to raise its orbit from around 350 kilometers up to around 600 kilometers so that it can continue its mission.
How long will that take? That seems like quite a distance.
We'll launch and we'll spend about 2 to 4 weeks doing some of the initial system checkouts and doing the proximity operations to bring our spacecraft closer to the SWIFT spacecraft. That'll take about 2 to 4 weeks. And then we'll thrust continuously for about 8 weeks as well, right? So all said and done, this is a 3-month mission. It might last a little bit longer depending on the exact altitude that SWIFT is at when we get to it, right? There's some uncertainty there. That's the importance of the flexibility of the spacecraft.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Ghani Lee. He's the CEO of Catalyst Space Technologies, which has been tasked with saving the Swift Observatory. I want to talk a bit about the urgency here. You mentioned this is a very, very quick turnaround that your company was asked to develop this mission to save Swift because there is the possibility that it may fall out of orbit, right? Tell me a bit about why that is the case, and then what challenges that presents to you in coming up with something to within a year, almost timeline to make it happen.
So just for context, NASA has invested approximately $400-500 million into this Swift telescope, right? That's the cost it took to build and launch and operate the telescope. It is a very valuable asset. And for context, the contract that they issued us is $30 million, right? That's to launch and rescue the telescope. That represents essentially a 10x return on their investment, right? The challenge here is how fast can you move, to your point, right? To go from a design to an actual spacecraft ready for launch in just about 9 months is a very complex operation. And not only that, we are doing one of the most challenging technical parts of space mission operations, the technical field known as rendezvous proximity operations and docking, right? Just fancy technical jargon for getting two spacecraft close to each other. The cool thing about that is we are bringing together robotics, we're showing that you can use commercial spacecraft to do these types of missions economically. And when you're able to do this type of maneuver on orbit, it means that you can start laying the foundation for future missions where you can rescue other types of space assets. We have a lot of space assets that could benefit from a capability like this. It's no fault of NASA. Space assets age, they get old, they get lower in altitude, they run out of propellant. And actually, it's a testament to the ingenuity of the engineers working on those teams that they're continuing to generate science. So if we can leverage robotic servicing missions like this, we can extend their lifetimes, make the science missions even better, and continue to, you know, help the missions along.
I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier in our conversation. You said that Swift was never designed to be serviced. And so you have to come up with a way that you can actually grab onto this thing without hurting it. How do you do that?
So the technical term for this is unprepared or non-cooperative, right? So we've had to get creative. There's a number of different structural interfaces that are on all spacecraft. These are things that they use during transportation, or these are things that they use to hook up the satellite to the rocket when it launches, right? So we've designed a robotic system that's capable of grappling on to a number of these different fixtures, right? And we have sensors on board our robotics that can determine the locations of these sensors and allow us to grip onto them in a safe way. And we have multiple points of contact as well. We have three different robotic arms. So essentially, we're giving this spacecraft a nice, gentle bear hug, right? Nice, stable. And from there, once we have a stable platform, we can begin thrusting and raising its altitude. This is what we hope to be, a repeatable, cost-effective blueprint for future missions, right? If we can service a non-prepared spacecraft, we can service other non-prepared spacecraft. And by doing that, we'll deploy more of these robotic systems, and then we'll have infrastructure we can build on.
I love that term, non-prepared. I also like non-cooperative. It's funny to think of a spacecraft being non-cooperative. But to your point, you're hoping that this is going to be a blueprint moving forward, because most satellites, if not all of them, don't have something to grapple onto, right? This was not a thought that you could do servicing, so these satellites aren't built. Is that kind of what the future is? Is you'll be able to go to different satellites based upon what you learn from the Swift Observatory mission?
That's exactly right. That's our vision, is for the future, we'll be able to dock spacecraft together routinely, almost as routine as parking a car. And to do that, we need, in the future, prepared interfaces. You want to have the USB port in space, right? One of the cool things about this is if you look at a regime of space called geosynchronous orbit, right? A lot of those spacecraft have similar geometric interfaces for how they connected to the launch vehicle, known as the launch adapter ring, right? And so that's what I call the tow hitch of a lot of these satellites, right? And so we've designed a system that's routinely able to grapple onto those systems. So that's the first step of repeatability.
This could certainly have implications in dealing with space junk, right? I mean, is that being considered as well?
space debris and space sustainability is very important, right? We have to know where objects are in space so that we can avoid potential collisions. And, you know, at a certain point, we want to be able to remove objects from space as well. I think that's of national importance, right? As well as global importance. I think that for a mission like this, $30 million to reboost a satellite is pretty much a bargain if you think about the value you're getting for the science mission. But if you had some critical pieces of debris that you had to remove, right, there's no reason that the same robotic system couldn't go around and grab a bunch of different objects and deorbit them as well, right? So we're seeing the pricing, the cost of these types of systems come just radically down, right? And that allows us to apply them to these different applications where in the past it was cost prohibitive, right? If it costs you $500 million to build a robotic spacecraft, you're not going to use that to deorbit objects because it just doesn't close, right? Versus in this case, we're seeing those curves start to converge.
How are you and your team feeling about moving towards launch day?
Our team is incredibly motivated. This is the type of thing that people want to get out of bed for, right? You think about, why do young students go to aerospace engineering school? They say, hey, I want to go do these crazy missions where we're building space robots to go grab onto space telescopes. That's something that a student might say. And we now have the amazing privilege to get to work with NASA and the US government to attempt this mission. It is something that is not without risk. NASA came into this eyes wide open. They said, hey, this is something that would move the needle in terms of what is possible with the industrial base, robotic servicing. It would have a big economic payoff for the science mission, and it would signify on behalf of the nation that we are doing these types of important missions, right? So everyone is very excited about this. I would say that if we can show that this is possible using a commercial service, right, with very economical resources, then we can do this over and over and over again, and many different groups can benefit. Not only additional NASA servicing missions, right? There's a bunch of other Earth science observatories that are just like SWIFT, right, that can benefit from a service like this, but also military assets can benefit from these types of robotic servicing missions as well, right? So there's a lot of stakeholders watching this, and we're really excited about this. There's a lot of work that needs to be done. We just completed our critical design review with the NASA team. That was a huge push, and the next 6 months are going to be a mad dash to the finish line as we build the flight spacecraft, as we go through environmental qualification testing, as we get out to ship out to the launch pad. It's going to be a fun time.
That was my conversation with Gani Lee, the CEO of Catalyst Space, from back in December. That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with the show. Follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at @AWTYSpace. If you got an idea for a future episode of the show, or you think you might make a great guest, well, email us. Our address is arewetheryet@cfpublic.org. Are We There? It is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance from LaToya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.